Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven. Hello and welcome back to our listeners. Today I have Tom Candy joining me. He's really big on animal welfare, behaviour and rescue. He has a BSc in bioveterinary science and an MSc in clinical animal behaviour. His whole bag is rescue and he's a clinical animal behaviourist. He also has a podcast, which I've really been enjoying listening to recently, and that's called Simplifying Shelter Behaviour. We haven't actually met yet in person, but we have tons of mutual friends. And I'm sorry to say, I don't even know which dogs he shares his life with, so I'll let him tell me and you about them. So welcome, Tom.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I really liked the episodes that I've listened to so far, so glad to be involved. And I've got one dog called Jess. She's a Finnish Lapland cross.
Nice.
And she's 10 next week. So I've had her for 8 years.
Wow.
So yeah, I got her when she was
rescue.
Two. Yes. Yeah. She came in from work. She was chosen for me though. So basically when I bought my house, I went to Florida for a conference, for a dog conference, and I was instructed my colleagues to have a dog ready for me when I got back. And I think I came back on the Sunday and she was in the house by Tuesday. So
wow.
They've done a good job finding her for me.
That's a big thing. I'm not sure that I could give up that much control and say to someone else, find me a dog. Wow.
Yeah, I was lucky in that my colleague at the time is one of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I did have quite a strict criteria. But yeah, she's slotted in really well. We travel a lot for work and she's great. We can go into a travel lodge and she gets straight on the bed and she knows what's what. So
she knows the score.
Yeah, she's done well in the last 10 years. Luckily, now she doesn't have to travel quite as much with me, which is nice for her.
But. Yeah. Oh, nice. Oh, no. I mean, I love Finnish Laplands anyway. I've got a friend who's got some. And that's good to know. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't know what dog or dogs you had.
That's all right.
But so let's get into it. What would you say has been your biggest learning point or mistake with dogs?
So it's such a good question that you start with. And obviously, like I said, I've watched a couple of your other episodes and I've been thinking about it quite a lot. And it's hard, isn't it? Because I know everybody says this, but there's a lot.
There is a lot.
And
yeah,
I think
that.
We always need to start with that level of self-reflection. But I think the big thing for me, like you mentioned, I pretty much solely work in rescue and shelter. And a big thing for me has been around goal setting and being really goal focused. So what I mean by that is, you know, quite often if a dog needs a muzzle before they can go home, our big focus is getting that dog muzzle trained, you know, using positive reward methods and working with the dog. But there's a time pressure on it. There's a goal. And I think as humans, we can be very goal focused, which often means we miss a lot of the stuff that comes around that. So without thinking about, well, actually, is the dog in the right state for learning? Or do we need to achieve other things first? Which a lot of the time feels like we're then going in a different direction. We might be delaying things because if we don't start muzzle training straight away, in theory, it's going to take a lot longer. But actually what I've found is, and why I now reflect back on this as my thing I would change if I could go back, is it probably takes about the same amount of time. I wouldn't say it was necessarily quicker, but you as the trainer, the dog and everybody else involved has such a better learning experience if you take those smaller steps and build up to it. And the reason that I like using muzzle training as the example for this is it's quite easy to then picture, because what I mean is we'd obviously do all of the things around making sure the dog feels safe, doing preference testing, all of that sort of stuff. But then we might start with a chin target, so not even holding anything that resembles a muzzle at all, and then moving to something like a yogurt pot, you know, and then moving up to a muzzle. But having that focus on the goal often takes you in that direction and you become quite focused on achieving it. And it means quite often you don't consider that whole picture of what's happening for that dog. And particularly, again, working in shelter and rescue, we've got dogs in very, very stressful environments. And there's a lot of groundwork that we could and should be doing before we start even considering behaviour modification.
Wow. I'll be honest, I totally get what you're saying with, you know, I'm bad for that, of like, and not even in rescue, of the, well, this is the end goal, we've got to get there, and almost being blinkered of all the other stuff that the dog is facing us with, and going, I need a bit more help here. No, we need to get to that end goal. Yeah, and I've definitely been guilty of that with my own dogs.
Well, the pressure comes from different places, doesn't it? So when we think about private clients, if we're doing, you know, training or behavior clients, the client wants to see the what they're paying for, don't they? Mm. Like, often we want to achieve certain things for our clients, A, because our aim is nearly always to improve the welfare of the dog in one way or the other, mm-hmm. but B, because the client's paying us. So yep. we want to feel like they're getting value for money. They want to feel like they're improving. And often the idea of saying, you're just not going to walk your dog for 2 weeks and we'll do all of these other things, but you're just not going to walk your dog for 2 weeks. People don't think that's what they're paying for. So then we get a little bit of imposter syndrome. Mm. Like, oh, is that really what we should be doing? Should we just be doing the TikTok videos on TikTok, you know, and training all of these cool things straight away because that's what the clients think we're paying for? And that's another big part of this, is not setting expectations when we start out. And that's really important when we think about dogs in rescue, when we think about dogs in homes, and when we think about us as individuals. Like, mm-hmm. we need to set our own expectations as well, because we know burnout is, it's pretty rife in our industry, and it's something else that we need to consider. So yeah, I think the goals question has always been something that's there, and like you said, I've definitely been there, and I'm generally quite a frustrated trainer, so I always think to, like, why don't you just put your nose in this muzzle and leave it there? Like, it's not a hard concept, but, you know, obviously the dogs don't get that.
No.
But, you know, again, we become so focused on that end goal that we don't go, without sounding really lame, you know, we get focused on the destination, but we're not concentrating on the journey.
Mm. When the magic, really we know the magic exactly. is in the journey, don't we?
Yeah. That's why we all travel, right? We don't just turn up and then leave again. So
this is true. Very true. I think that this also applies to, like, a broader picture, as in, I know that I've had dogs before that I've got with a goal in mind. I mean, one of them, one of my own currently, I got her with a couple of goals. One of them I reached, as in, she was going to be a brood bitch. She was going to carry on my line. The other side was she was going to be a rally dog. And she kind of has been. Like, she's doing all right, but she's now 7. Time is starting to run out, as in, you know, for her health and my time of being able to put that time into her and take her around the country competing. And, you know, that's just like the effects of COVID, divorce, life changes. You know, it's just the way life's took us both. But that was always the goal. And I do kind of stop myself sometimes, because in my head I'm like, yeah, but she should be doing more. She should be doing this. Has she asked for any of that? No. Does she care whether she's on the sofa or at a competition? Probably not. But I think and I see it with clients where they've got a dog with a specific goal in mind, whether it's, you know, they want that dog to, and it might be a rescue dog, to be the dog that they go hiking with and they go camping with and they get to travel around the country with, but that dog is never going to be that dog. Because it's too anxious, or, you know, it's just not programmed that way to be confident in those environments. Yes, that you can make improvements, and yes, you know, we can help it, but it will never be the dog that actually thrives off that. And that I find that for a lot of people, that's where a lot of the guilt and the kind of the emotional trauma comes from, where they are constantly in this cyclical battle with themselves about what they'd got that dog for, and dealing with the fact that that is not the dog to do that with. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with everything you've just said. And I've got a case example that really nicely demonstrates that point, actually. So we had a collie. She was in rescue for a little while, and then we found this amazing foster home who were really keen to take her on, and they did take her on. And they live in quite a busy seaside town. So, you know, during the summer, it is busy, it is dog friendly. It's not really where you want a dog reactive dog to go. And their life was lots of beautiful coastline walks around the coast of Wales and all of these different things where they encountered other dogs. And they had this dog in foster for a year, and they were working with her and did some amazing progress, but were really struggling to see that progress, because for them, they weren't achieving the goals that they wanted to achieve in the same way that you were just saying. And we had this conversation, because they were debating whether or not she had it wasn't that she would come back to rescue, it's that we'd look for another home for her from foster. But they were saying, you know, she fits into our life so well in 90% of the time, this is just the issue. And I was like, right, okay, well, what's the concern? And they said, well, we can't do long walks with our friends because we find it too stressful if we take her. So we're happy not taking her, but then we can't leave her in the house for more than 4 hours. And this is where the interesting bit comes in, and hopefully I'm not going to be shot down by the listeners, because I am obviously an animal welfare professional. Animal welfare is my life. But I said, okay, well, why? What's the thing with the 4 hours for you then? And they said, well, that's the advice. That's what everything says. And I actually think it's one of the most difficult pieces of advice that the general population have put out there. Because I said, right, okay, well, what does the dog do when she's left? Oh, she just sleeps. She's really happy. She just sleeps. We've got a camera. We watch her. And I said, right, okay, does that change in hour 3 or hour 4? And they said, no, she's fine. So, okay, well, how often do you want to do walks with your friends? Oh, like maybe once a fortnight or something. I said, right, okay, I'm going to tell you a little secret. I said, I like scuba diving. I go scuba diving. And when I go scuba diving, I'm out of the house for 12 hours because you're on the tides, and it takes us an hour to get to Lundy Island where we go, and it takes us 12 hours. So before my partner moved in, there was, you know, once or twice a month when my dog was left for 12 hours. And same thing, I had a camera. I know she was perfectly happy. You know, we came back, we walked straight away, and her first thing to do wasn't go to the toilet. You know, she wasn't sat in the house busting. We'd normally do another 10-minute walk before she went to the toilet. And obviously that would be one day in a 4-week period where, yes, most of the time she's not left at all.
You're not expecting her to do it Monday to Friday, week in, week out.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it's all about that individual. And that's why we ask those questions for that dog around, well, how is the dog when they're left? Because what you've got to think of is that overall picture. So A, the clients were struggling with the idea of not going on long walks for their friend. B, the dog would have struggled with those long walks. And the alternative was she stays at home occasionally by herself for maybe 6 hours. Or she has to go through the process of finding another home, different people who might cope better or worse with her behaviour, and have this effect. So I think it really highlights everything that you said, and then everything we've just talked about with that case example, highlights that importance of the study of one and looking at the dog in front of you when we're coming up with these holistic plans. So moving away from goals and thinking what's right for that individual and how can we create that to fit, because ultimately when we're working with owners, we're there for the dogs, but the owners are our clients, and we've got to mash the two together. So, and they're the ones doing the work. So that's my, you know, my frustration, like I said, is really in rescue you have such limited time, and our advice is always, or I, you know, I know lots of professionals who say you want to do your kettle training, so you do a 2-minute session while the kettle's boiling or when the TV adverts are on. But often in rescue, we're only getting the dog out twice a day. So you're sort of pushing through criteria quicker than you want to.
Yep.
Well, we don't have to do that when we've got clients, but we need to encourage them in the right way and set them up for those success. And that's kind of the contrary, I suppose, to the point we made right at the start, is I do still use goals, even though I think being goal-focused is wrong. I still use goals, but in a way that encourages success for the dog and the client, and isn't a barrier to success.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I am very, I'm always kind of kicking my clients' backsides into, you know, like long-term clients, where I'm like, right, what's your goals? We're going to smash them, but we're going to smash them over a year. You know, like it's not a, like in rescue, you've got what, a matter of days, weeks, months, maybe. But at the end of the day, the whole point is you want that dog to meet that criteria and reach that goal in the quickest possible time so it can find the best possible home. But at the same time, yes, you can. I do agree that you can become too goals focused, where it just takes over your life. And the dog is the one who actually suffers with the fallout of that, I think.
Yeah, and the way that I do it now when I talk about or when I create behaviour modification plans is actually using smart targets. So some people might have heard of that. It's a very sort of business-focused approach to setting goals and targets. And it stands for specific, oh my God, this is where the dyslexia kicks in and I can't remember the letters. So specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timely. So they're the things that we should be considering when we're working with our clients. Really specific goals that are easy to achieve, so that encourages that forward motion. So again, if we take that back to our muzzle training example, we might say, right, we need to muzzle train this dog. Well, our goal shouldn't be the dog wearing a muzzle for 10 minutes. It should be finding a muzzle that fits properly. It should then be, can the dog target the muzzle? Can the dog hold their nose in for 4 seconds, 5 seconds, you know, so that we're still driving clients forward, but we're able to give feedback, we're able to show progress, and then we can reflect back on what's happening to either make changes or say, do you know what, you're doing a super well job, let's keep going with it. Because the other thing when you're super goal focused is when you look back, you've got a much bigger gap to look at. So if you're saying, oh, well, my dog's not muzzle trained yet, that's quite deflating if you've been doing it for 3 weeks. But if you look back and go, oh, God, the first time I showed the dog the muzzle, they ran out of the room if they've had a bad experience. But now they're targeting the muzzle. That's a massive achievement.
Of course it is. You can say, like, they've ticked off 5 steps. That's 5 steps they didn't have before.
Yeah. So when I say, moving away from goal-focused, really what I mean is thinking about how we use goals to benefit the dog and not benefit ourselves.
Yeah. Ego and, criteria and things like that that needs to be filled for rescue. I get that. Totally. Cool. No, that was really interesting. So next then, what have you got any more? Well, you said there's loads, so let's go into something else of learning points or mess ups.
Oh, that's a great one. the other thing I'm thinking about, just because I mention it all the time, is hands in treat pouches. It is like anytime I see a video, anytime I'm like, so a lot of my role now is working with people and teaching rather than working with dogs. And I forever still have my hand in a treat pouch and therefore have to constantly say to everybody, don't be doing what I'm doing and having your hand in a treat pouch. But the reason I think that is a good thing to bring up is it then links into the idea of expectations for the dog and frustration. So one of the big issues is obviously if we've got our hand in the treat pouch, the dog A might not be paying proper attention to us because they're like, there's a treat coming because your hand's in the pouch. Or B, that expectation might be there. And if we then don't meet that expectation because we go off and do something else, we possibly get frustration. And if we think about the definition of frustration, it's when a dog is thwarted from doing something they want to do, so stopped from doing something they want to do or doing something they want to achieve, where their previous expectations haven't been met, or where there are barriers to autonomous control. And they are 3 things that I can guarantee you are happening to every dog in a kennel environment.
Yeah.
So that thing of having your hand in a treat pouch seems like, oh, it's just like a mechanical thing, it's just a bit geeky dog trainer thing, but actually it can mean a hell of a lot to the dog you're working with in a range of contexts. So that's one of my other sort of pet hates that I find myself doing all of the time and haven't got out of it yet, but that you need to think about. And the tip that I have for that, if you also do it, and like I said, I'm by no way perfect, so I probably shouldn't even be crossing the boundary of giving tips, but if you've got trousers with a belt loop, putting your thumb through your belt loop is a great way to keep your hand out of the place. And that's also a great tip if you're teaching loose lead walking and you have the magic floating owner hand of the lead coming up because they're focusing on trying to reward the dog for being next to them. And gradually you see that hand going higher and higher. Getting your client to pop their finger through your belt loop is also a really great way to reduce that when you're doing loose lead walking.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know I've been guilty of that, and I have more of a magic pocket than a magic hand in treat pouch, and my hand does gravitate towards the magic pocket quite a lot. But I'm always, like, currently I'm working within the Restart Dog Project, so that's training prisoners how to be dog trainers and things like that. So, and I am constantly like, hands out of your treat pouch, hands, relax your hands. And then it's like a comfort blanket. it's no, no, no. I can get the treat out quick and I can reward them quick. And, you know, I do it with clients as well. And the amount of times, especially teaching loose lead walking, that's a great example, where I'm like, just relax your hand. Just like you make your hand floppy and then mark and then get the treat. But yeah, and the whole, you know, helium balloon with the other one, that's with the other hand. Yeah, great example.
It's really interesting. So I did the Pet Professional Guild conference in October, and I did a couple of sessions with Portal, which is like a tabletop training
game.
We've got it
in the prison.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's really good. And even then, it was so interesting to watch people like mess with the little, so you use little wooden blocks and they act as your treats. And people are just sat there messing with them or holding them or trying to pick them up. And I'm just always sat there reminding people, no, come on, back to your start position, back to your start position. And I think we need to do that when we do our own training. And that's why it's so useful to video yourself, isn't it? However it is. Uncomfortable that is. Because I'm sure we all hate it. I definitely hate it.
The amount of times, like, I video myself all the time because I'm always creating video content for my membership. And I must try, like, I reckon 95% of training my own guys is filmed. And, you know, that doesn't all go out. Don't get me wrong, it really doesn't. But I watch it back sometimes and I go, oh my God, Sarah, what were you doing? Like, really? No wonder the dog got frustrated. No wonder the dog went off and sniffed over there, because you were all over the place and not being clear. And yeah, really, really useful to video yourself. But yeah, not always put it out there because it's shower of shit half the time.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's really tricky, isn't it? It's a road for a different day.
but it does make you better, because you look at it and you go, well, I ain't ever doing that again.
Well, and there's so much that you miss that you don't see if you don't watch videos back. So there's a video of me that I use regularly in training where I'm working with a reactive dog, and we're having a great session, and then somebody puts a dog into a compound next to where we're working after I'd radioed to say don't put any dogs in this compound, and this dog's head picks up and my dog goes over a threshold and really kicks off. And every time I watch that video back, there's more and more that I would change or do differently or think about. Whereas in the moment, because you're just focusing on that dog that's reacting, you don't really consider any of those aspects. And obviously, neither of us are saying put the dog into a situation and film it. But if you're filming things regularly anyway, you pick up these moments, which are then either really useful for teaching. Again, from that rescue and shelter point of view, people's learning is better and more consolidated if you show them videos of the dog that they're taking home, or if you show them videos at like end of story compared to pieces of paper or just explaining something. If we can show the actual work we've done, that massively helps success with adoption. But it also means, again, you can reflect back on where that dog was and you can pick up on these little bits, or we can use them as teachable moments when we're working with other clients, other adopters, other professionals, or whatever we're doing with our content.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I'm loving the fact that you are putting, I mean, my last rescue, I'm quite ashamed to say, was probably 15 years ago now, the last time I took on a rescue. I fostered quite a bit over the years, but my actual rescue that I took home, I used to volunteer at Manchester Dogs Home years ago, and you know, failed foster, an old Doberman. But I'm loving the fact that you are sending home videos with new owners, because I can see how that really would start to make a difference, that people can see that, okay, it is possible with my dog that I've just brought home, and this is what we need to do. That's really reassuring for me, and I apologize that I am quite not ignorant, but like very separated from the rescue world nowadays. It's just my life has took me very much in a different direction.
Well, there's a couple of things to dive into there. I think firstly, I don't think you should apologize for not having had a rescue dog in 15 years. Again, this is breaking all of the molds of what a lot of people will say about rescues, but I think, you know, there are situations where you are in a part of your life where bringing a rescue dog in makes complete sense. Personally, I never want a puppy I cannot think of anything worse than having a puppy. I'm very happy taking a two-year-old dog who I already know roughly what they're going to be like. I know what they look like. I know what size they are. Hopefully they're toilet trained, because majority of dogs are going to be at least some level of toilet trained compared to a puppy. But that doesn't fit everybody. And I think as an industry, what we need to do is make sure welfare across the board is as good as possible. So there are obviously issues with purchasing dogs from a breeder that need to be addressed. But I don't personally see that as a separate thing to you getting a rescue dog. So I think that's, you know, just a really important message to get out there. It's not wrong to get a puppy, but you should always think about how you can help rescues in other ways. So if, and again, a sad point, but you know, if you're getting a puppy because your other dog has sadly passed away or anything like that, and you've got your bedding and stuff that you don't want to use with your new dog, dropping that at a rescue is still a great way to help out. If you are a trainer, you know, offering your time in response for them, maybe putting in a little leaflet with a discount code in, so that when the dog goes home, they ring you up. But you know, we, adopting isn't the only way we can support rescues, and I think it's important we remember that. And then the other thing that I was going to pick up on is, I can't actually remember now because that was such a long story that I told. But what did you say? Using videos. Oh, yeah. The other thing, again, it comes back to that point about expectation, doesn't it? So often when we're saying to people, oh, you know, this is Fido, he can react, he can lunge and bark when he sees other dogs at this distance, often you get, oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I can totally cope with that. And then what happens is the dog goes home, does exactly the behavior that you say they're going to do, and then that person ends up returning the dog because, you know, in reality, they actually can't cope with it. So again, we wouldn't actively want to set up any situations to film where we see this happening. But if we're recording our walks occasionally, chances are they're going to happen. It's really hard to avoid all triggers in a rescue setting. And that means then you can have that expectation conversation early doors, and then support person through that journey of adoption, rather than waiting right to the end. And then normally what happens is, as they take the dog into the car park to take them home, somebody else walks past with a dog, and that's the first time they ever see that dog react. And then you're on the back foot straight away. So, yeah, I think it is, I hate filming myself. It's really tricky. If you try and use a GoPro, you get great videos of your feet normally. You know, unless there's two of you, it's actively difficult to film. But it is really worthwhile to film, you know, a couple of training sessions, a couple of walks, for all of the reasons that we've talked about, really.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay, I love the, like, I love the fact that you're so blunt in the fact of, I never want a puppy. Just not happening. When puppies are totally my bag. But I also found it really interesting how you said that with a two-year-old, for example, you know what the size they are. You know kind of what you're getting. You can get to know them, and they are pretty, you know, settled, as it were. If that's the dog you're getting. When me being, like, me as an individual, I'm very much like, obviously, most of us as dog trainers, we're kind of control freaks to a certain extent because, you know, that's part of the job. But in a nice way, not in a, like, a controlling way. But and it's funny how I love puppies when you really do not know how they're going to turn out. You know, like, they are not clean slates. Puppies are not. They come pre-programmed. There are things that you can do to help them. There are things that you can do to kind of tweak things. But at the end of the day, that kind of from birth to 2 years, that's a very unknown journey, and I've never really thought about it that way. That's really, it's like some self-reflection there, but it's really interesting for me that you're like, okay, no, I know, like, I can get to know a dog, and then that's it.
And it comes back to you know, why do you want a dog in the first place? What fits in with your life? Because the reality for me is, it just wouldn't work. Like I said, I travel a lot for work. I'm away 2 or 3 days a week. I know people who have had puppies in travel lodges, and one of my colleagues previously has had to go to a 24-hour Tesco's at 2 o'clock in the morning because the puppies had diarrhea all over travel lodge. You know,
oh, no.
That just does not fit into my life plan at the minute. Maybe that'll change in the future, but I also don't. I know realistically I don't have that time to invest in getting things right for a puppy, which is what you want to do. You also want to get things right for an adult dog, of course, but the expectations are different because the expectations of the dog are different. And yes, the idea often is that, you know, if you get a puppy, you've got that better chance of success, haven't you, in inverted commas? Because, like you said, they're not clean slates, but the learning history is generally a lot less. But that's enough to put some pressure on.
It does. You are totally, totally right. Like, it really does put pressure on. I mean, we're keeping Ada, so I've got a Labrador here. And she kind of, I was fostering her as part of the Restart Dog project. And she came to me when she was about 10 weeks. And I love having a puppy. That's just me. So I was like, oh, puppy. And she gets to come into work with me and all of that kind of stuff. And she gets to be trained by the lads in work. And time's moved on. And obviously, she's now staying. But during this process, because she's just turned a year now. But during this process, I put my name down for a flat coat retriever puppy. My heart dog was a flat coat retriever. I lost him in 2019. Life has been all over the place. I was finally getting to a kind of stage where I thought I could take on a big dog puppy. And I knew there'd be a lot of pressure there because one on myself and just it'd never be the same as my other dog. And, you know, just lots of that going around my head. And the breeder I know and trust, you know, really do. And I kind of had my name down for ages and they were going to be born this summer. But because I'd got Ada, we had lots of conversations, but basically I kind of went, I'm not having a flatty, even though I'm only fostering Ada, I don't want to give up on her because I wouldn't have had both. I've got three little Daxies as well. And there's only room at the minute in my life for one big dog. I love them, but it's just one big dog, little things. And it's funny now, actually looking back, part of the reasoning, I think, was that pressure of, well, it was a foster, so, you know, it was okay. But buying a puppy in that is specifically mine and not, you know, and not going into work and all of that kind of stuff. At the minute, I think some of that was that me recognising that pressure and this route is easier.
Mm. And people forget, and I'm not saying this is strictly true of you, but people forget that actually the last time they had the puppy, in most situations, obviously it's not always set, but most situations, the last time somebody has had a puppy was 10 years ago. So you're 10 years older. You have forgotten what it's like. And people say this about babies as well, don't they? But, you know, you've forgotten what it's like. You've forgotten everything being chewed, you having to get rid of all your cushions until the dog stopped mouthing and all of these different things you've got to do, going out to the toilet every 20 minutes, all of these things you do, you forget. So then you bring a puppy back into your life and remember what it's like, remember that you're 10 years older and it might not be the fit that you want. So I think it's just thinking about the reality of it. I'm very lucky. I have access to puppies. I can get puppy cuddles at work.
You can get your fix.
I can leave the puppies at work, knowing that they nearly always have a good home. They always have a good home to go to. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer. Hmm. And every time I see a puppy, I think, I do not want a puppy. The closest I've ever been was a six-month-old Malinois who actually, in the end, went to the police. I think went to a service and he was amazing and he was cuddly and he was toy driven and food driven and, you know, perfect for going as a working dog. And then I was like, why would you want a Malinois? why would that at all be a good idea? So, you know, that dream shattered very quickly. But yeah, every time I actually spend time with a puppy, it just solidifies my idea that for my lifestyle, it isn't a good match. I'm much better off with slightly older dogs who can, you know, adjust that little bit quicker, whatever the situation is. But I think, again, it comes back to the idea of making sure you think about the whole picture and things on an individual level, because obviously not all puppies are the same as well.
No. And I think because I've had nine puppies of my own. Never mind the ones, you know, I've bred four litters, but that they're not included within that. And I think there is, like, I've had plenty of Daxi puppies, basically. And in my mind, I can deal with that because, and my last Daxi, I mean, she's two now, so it's not that long ago. And in my mind, you've got 10 months of puppiness. And they're pretty mature because they're a small breed. They grow up quick and I can deal with 10 months. Having a big dog, like, so Merlin, my flatty, was massive, like bigger than the normal breed standard. And he was, you know, typical flat coat, absolutely full of beans, loved life, very exuberant and a very big dog. And I'm 5 foot. So, and so part of that, I think, when I kind of postponed having a flatty again, was the, it's one thing having a puppy for, like, a Daxi puppy for 10 months. It's another thing having something that is, well, forever, that breed, they are forever puppies in their behaviour, but really a good 2 years of absolute hard graft and annoyingness and frustration and all of that when the teenage hormones kick in. And yeah, and that, I think that was the probably the biggest difference for me. And ironically, I love puppies up until about 16 weeks. And then obviously, we all know hormones start to kick in at that point. And then it's like, please, someone else take them until they're about two, because they're doing my nutting.
Well, it's interesting that you went down that line, because I was just thinking, oh, we've talked a lot about puppies and we haven't even mentioned adolescents. So that was a really nice segue into that side of the conversation. And the reason that I think it's interesting to bring that up is, you know, as COVID was starting, and I know you can't get away from the C word, but as COVID was starting, everybody was like, oh, shit's going to hit the fan. You know, rescues are going to be inundated with dogs. It's going to be mega busy. Everybody's going to be giving up their dog. And it just didn't happen. And actually, a lot of rescues that I work with were really successful during COVID because everybody wanted a dog. So you actually
got time on their hands.
Yeah, and everybody was at home. So you did, a lot of problem behaviors disappeared, in inverted commas, or you didn't see all of these things, or people thought they had time to get a dog. So actually, we couldn't keep dogs in kennels quick, you know, for long enough, really. What did happen was after COVID, about 6 months after COVID, we started to get a lot of dogs in as they hit adolescence, and you then start to have all of those problems. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we often think puppies are really hard work, but actually they're kind of hard work all the way through. And I just went for a weekend away with some uni friends who are not dog people. They all now have dogs. And one of them has got a Labrador Cross Springer. And they were saying, oh, she's two now. She'll start to calm down, won't she? And I was like,
maybe not.
I don't think so, though. Probably not. But, you know, this expectation of, again, what it's like having a puppy and then moving through to adolescence, because it's so, it's such a tricky part of life for dogs in the world that we live in now. It's just interesting that you brought that up, because that was exactly where my brain went as well.
Good. I also think that it's hard for owners with adolescent dogs, because they've gone from that everyone wants to interact with this cute little puppy, and, you know, and fawning over it. Oh, I must come over and visit you because I know you've got a puppy and I need to come and meet them. And then suddenly this dog has grown in size, but mentally it's not mature. So it's got all these long limbs that are like everywhere, and they're so clumsy with it, and they don't realize where their back end is, or that, like, their strength or anything like this, because they're still, their brain is still developing and learning all of these things. And I find then that's when, like, say at 6 months, let's a Labrador, for example, in a pet home, or that kind of size of dog, then you'll get these same family friends and things like that that'll be like, oh, is that dog not trained yet? Because now it's big and now it's a problem, when actually it's only like 3 months after you last saw it, and of course it's not going to be grown up. And then the owners have put so much pressure on themselves then, well, they are a big dog, they should be trained. And it's like, but the dog cannot physically, like, control itself quite yet, and they've got so much developing to do. That's not to say, like, I have a lot of sympathy for the dog at this age, and of course the owner, but at the same time, if it was a dog in my own house, I'd understand it, but internally I'm like, oh, for God's sake, can we just fast forward 18 months or 2 years or whatever it may be.
Yeah, well, interestingly though, isn't it, because that brings us back to where we started the conversation around being goal focused as humans. Because again, what we don't talk about is adolescent dogs generally need more support. They are going through hormonal changes, they have all of this neuroplasticity, changes in the brain happening, things changing, new associations being formed that weren't there before. And actually, that's the time where we need to say, we probably shouldn't be training this dog. But we focus on, right, okay, we don't want them to jump up, so we'll teach them to do a sit, rather than thinking, oh, when some visitors come over, I might set up for some free work, different stations, and let them explore and investigate in a way that allows them to be part of the picture, but they're not doing that jumping up behavior. But we're also not having that expectation of them of being able to sit still. Mm. And again, this is another thing that we talk about a lot in rescue, not so much just with adolescents, but this idea that often, and it's a really sensible training plan, but often if we've got a dog who struggles to have their harness on or jumps up at us when we first go in the kennel, we get them to stand on their bed, and then you can clip them up and harness them. And like I said, that's a great end point to be at. But for a dog who's been in a kennel for probably 23 hours a day, realistically, who somebody's just come into the kennel and that means they're leaving, that is a lot of emotion to try and contain onto a platform.
It is.
If we do something like encourage them to pick up a toy, scatter feed some treats, cheese wall is one of my favourites. So
cheese
using
wall?
Yeah, so Primula or you know, pate or something like that, and you literally just squirt it all over the wall. And top tip for shelters, which a colleague said to me that I always remember as well, is if you're filming it and you write the dog's name, it's then a great thing to put on Instagram to sell the dog, because nothing's cuter than seeing the dog lick their name, off their wall.
Yeah. Love that.
You know, whilst we're harnessing them up. So we have to think about, again, it's fine to have the goal, but thinking about how we get there is super important when we're talking about adolescents, because of everything else they've got going on.
Yeah.
And our expectations are normally so much. And again, you know, when you were saying about the dogs jumping up and then 2 weeks later it's not cute anymore, that's exactly where my brain went as well. Mm. So it's great to see this conversation kind of flowing through that idea of goals and expectations and how much they do impact on things.
They do. And I think, like, currently I am, so Ada the Labrador is very much my other half's. He's fallen in love, but he was not. He's always loved dogs, but he's not doggy, if you know what I mean. And he loves the Daxies, but, you know, he's really fallen in love with Ada. So he's like, this is my dog. And he's like, you're going to have to teach me how to walk her and things like this. And you know, he's doing all the wrong things. And just because he doesn't know any better. And I'm trying to get through to him that it's all well and good if you're walking and she's pulling and you're continuing to walk. One, well, you know, me being very the blunt me that I am, well, you're teaching her to pull because she's getting to go where she wants. But the other side of it is just trying to get him to understand the fact that it's not about you're not training or you are training. It's the fact that the dog is learning all the time, whether you like it or not. And I think this is something that a lot of pet owners and things don't quite realise, that it's not about training mode is on and my hand's in my treat pouch or whatever it may be, and then when I've not got my treat pouch, training mode is off. It's the dog is learning what works and what doesn't work all the time. And I'm a big person on management, and definitely in adolescence, like, management is key. Of when I say management for the listeners, it's very much like preventing them practicing the wrong behaviors. It's not improving them in any way, but it's just like, for example, a dog that doesn't come back when it's off lead, you manage that situation by having them on lead or on a long line, because they're not getting to practice not coming back, because they're not going in the first place. But yeah, I mean, have you got any thoughts on kind of management and kind of dogs learning all the time and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, and we need to remember what behavior is for. And, you know, Susan Friedman, who's amazing, if people haven't heard of her, definitely look her up. She's a really big name in the ABA world, applied behavior analysis. But she always says, right, okay, if you ask somebody, and I'll ask you, so Sarah, so what are your eyes for?
To see.
Okay, what are your ears for?
To hear.
What are your mouth for?
To eat and speak. Yeah, I feel like I'm going to get things. Caught out here.
What's your behavior for? And people always struggle to answer that question. But the reality is, our behavior is there to interact with our environment. That's why we do things. And that looks obviously different. That could be that we want something to be further away from us. It would be could be that we want to investigate something. But it's generally to interact with the environment. So that idea of, like you said, that management and thinking about that constant learning is really important. The way that I generally approach anything that I'm considering, particularly if it's problem behavior, is the 3R model. So that stands for risk assessment, which is pretty self-explanatory, just considering what risks there are when you're working with that dog. Then your reduce, which is your management, but we know dog trainers love an acronym. So we've gone for reduce, and then resolve, which is how we actually get our behavior modification. So I think it is a really essential part of what we do. Dogs are going to make mistakes. People are going to make mistakes. And management is there to help reduce that whilst we work on other elements of life. And I was working with a dog this week and a member of staff, and we were doing some lucid walking training. So we were doing a variation on super bowls from Leslie McDevitt, so using bowls as a target. The dog got it super good in the run, and then we left the run and the dog was back to being a steam train, as you would expect, because that learning was very situational. We'd only done one session. It was in a very specific place, etc., etc. And we had that conversation around, okay, well, this is why we use harnesses. And then when we're doing the training, we might pop the dog onto a collar, or we might use a specific cue. Mm-hmm. Because we've also got to remember that, like you said, there are times where the dog isn't going to be in the right headspace for training. The person's not going to be in the right headspace for training, or something else is happening and we just want to do a little bit of training and then give the dog a bit of freedom or something. So we quite often talk about having set routes at the centre where you practice your lucid walking, and then the rest of the time the dog can do other things. Mm-hmm. And the general day-to-day equivalent is normally if somebody's got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, or they've just got in from work and they're doing a quick walk with the dog, they don't want to be stopping every time the dog pulls and luring the dog back and rewarding them every step, or, you know, whatever method of loosely walking you're doing. So using the harness gives that dog that differing information.
Yeah. Leisure mode versus training mode.
Exactly. And it brings us back to that expectation thing, doesn't it? But links management in. I think the one thing to think about with management is it can fail, and it often will fail eventually, which is why we also need to make sure we're doing the other side of things. And I did a Facebook post last night, or on a Monday, for Muzzle Monday, about different types of muzzles. And at the bottom I put, you know, muzzles aren't a long-term solution for managing problem behavior. And somebody said, well, why not? And it's a great question. But the answer is because they're management. So yes, a muzzle might prevent a dog picking something up, or injuring somebody, or, you know, whatever reason you've put that muzzle on the dog, but we're not addressing underlying motivations, which ultimately is what gets us success, in inverted commas. So yes, that's a long-winded answer to say I think like management's super important.
It is. And like you say, with the muzzle example towards the end there, you know, at the end of the day, a muzzle isn't addressing the emotional core of where that behaviour that you're trying to prevent is coming from. You're just preventing the damage.
Yeah, exactly. And it's considering all of those different aspects, isn't it? So it's considering your environment, your emotions, and your motivations, and how those three points of your triangle combine together to end up with whatever behavior you're looking at. And we need to adjust things around that, don't we? So to start with, you nearly always have a high level of management when you're working with a new dog or a new client, and quite a low level of training. And then gradually, as you give the dog skills, as you change the environment and the expectation, your management can come down because the dog's starting to make better choices. And like, to use your example earlier, you know, at some point, even if you've taught a dog to do a recall, if you're going in a field of sheep, I would hope most people would still have the dog on the lead, because there's quite a high chance of that management failing. Yeah. If you then go to an empty park with the same dog, you might let them off lead because you've trained those skills in that situation.
Yeah, totally. And I think,
what did you say? Go and get a collie.
I said, don't get cocky, because that's essentially what it is, isn't it? Well, my dog can be off lead, and I've got a great recall. Now I'm going to do it in an environment where my dog could get shot. with, you know, the field full of sheep. So yeah, and one of my pet hates, and I don't know whether, I don't think I'm on my own with this one, but I'll wait to see your view, of the cockiness of when people are walking their dogs. I won't name a breed, but there is a specific breed that you see it most commonly, which I love, by the way. I'm not against the breed. Where you'll walk down the street and the dog is just trotting lovely next to the owner. Like, it is a picture of beauty, but there is no lead, but they're walking along a main road. And that is, that's the picture of beauty, but also a picture of cockiness, because you don't know what that dog's going to do. A squirrel could come out, a cat, anything. That dog could get run over at any moment, but they are that cocky that they're like, no, my dog can do it. One, it's an offence to do that anyway by a public highway, which, you know, I like to point out to people, and that doesn't go down well, but that's a fact. But two, do you want your dog to die?
Yeah, it's a great point, isn't it? There's not really much to counter with it. But I had an interesting experience at the weekend, which is slightly different, but it was a bit of a natural reinforcer. So my dog's a bit temperamental with other dogs. It's not mm-hmm. always consistent. She's much older now as well, as we've already discussed. So she's a bit sore and a bit uncomfortable. So we generally keep her on lead. We were at the weekend, like I mentioned, we were away with some friends who've got other dogs. She gets on with those dogs. She was fine with them all weekend. And we were in a really quiet area. And, you know, she has a recall. Even though she's on lead all the time, we've taught her recall. She's got skills. She comes back. All great. Well, we were sort of humming and awing, but we decided in the end, we won't let her off because it was quite foresty, so we couldn't see as much distance as I would like with my reactive dog. So we kept her on lead. And then the two other dogs that were off lead went into this horrible, stagnant, stinky lake. And I was very, very happy that I hadn't let my fluffy Finnish lap-hound off lead. So not really what we were talking about, but shows sometimes funny. Management is a really useful tool.
Yeah, it is.
Because we had a five-hour drive, and I would not have enjoyed sitting next to my dog for 5 hours on that day.
No. I did drive back from Derbyshire back to Manchester once with my dog, who had eaten a whole cow pat and then threw it up on the back seat.
Yeah. Nice.
Not fun. Anyway, well, usually I'd kind of, at this point, usually I'd kind of ask, like, what are your top three tips of things to avoid? But I think you've covered them. I think that's pretty much our content. Unless you've got anything else that you want to add to them before I kind of move on to the next thing.
No, I think the three for me that I always consider are, you know, think about the holistic approach. Think about your bigger picture. It's not just about the goals. It's about what does life look like for that dog overall? And how can we adapt that to get to where we need to be for the client, for the dog, whatever we're working with? I think that's really the main sort of takeaway from this conversation is thinking about that individual approach. Every dog's different. And I guess my third one is sometimes you just need a break. And like I said, I've been in multiple situations where I'm very frustrated about how training's going. And sometimes taking a break is the best thing for you. It gives the dog the opportunity to have a breath and consolidate their learning. And mistakes will happen. We're all human.
That's this whole podcast.
Yeah. Even the best trainers in the world, your dog's going to go over threshold. You're going to make a training error. Something's going to happen that you weren't expecting. And what we've got to do is create a world for that dog where those mistakes don't have any, you know, major impact on that experience. And the easiest example to think about with this that I use all the time is thinking about a bank account. So we want to make plenty of entries to the bank account to build up our resilience, build up our amount. So if we have to make a withdrawal, if we've got to do a vet visit that we weren't expecting, or a dog comes around the corner and our dog goes over threshold, we're not going into our overdraft. We're able to keep in the green and not have to worry too much about it. So thinking about how every interaction we have with our dog creates that safety net for us, because things will go wrong. And that's, you know, the question that you asked at the start. I think that's the other thing that I've had to learn is to, like, don't stress about the mistakes. Think about the benefit from them. And yes, adjust what you're doing next time so we don't get a repeat as much as possible. But just move on. They're just things that happen. And they're a learning opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. Which, you know, like, as I said before, that's very much the theme of my whole podcast is we all make mistakes as long as we learn from them. And let's share them to make others feel better. Thank you. Would you like to tell the listeners kind of how they can find you, the kind of stuff, like if you're doing any client work, I'm not sure if you are, more about your podcast, all of that kind of shizzle, please.
Yeah, definitely. So like you said at the start, I run Simplifying Shelter Behaviour. So that at the minute is mainly a Facebook group and an Instagram website coming soon. But it is there to put out as best information as possible as I can to people mainly working in shelter and rescues. But like we've talked about, it's a really difficult environment to be in, which means we've often got some great ideas that people can also use with dogs in the homes or clients that they're working with. So it's still worth checking out. As part of that, we also run a podcast, the same name, and that's on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And then the other thing just to mention as well is I'm the principal instructor for the Grisha Stewart Academy. So we've got tons of really great courses. We've got a great lineup for 2025, which is going to be webinars. But then following the webinar, we're sort of doing a themed month where we're going to be looking at case discussions based around that topic, previous webinar discussions, looking back at how things have changed. So in January, we're doing resilience with Bobby Bambury. And then in February, we're doing urban dogs with Melissa McHugh McGrath, who's awesome. So it's worth having a look at there. And we offer quite a few different scholarships for people of the global majority and rescues and shelters and a couple of other categories. So they're sort of the two main places to find me.
Fab. Thank you. Yeah, no, honestly, I've really, really enjoyed this. And I cannot thank you enough for joining me. I'm hoping there were lots of learning points there for the listeners. I've picked up a couple of things. Cheese wall. Loving it.
Cheese wall is the way forward.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really useful. It's probably less well accepted in homes if you suggest doing it all over somebody's nice painting. But, you know, baths is great for the bath.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly that. I've seen leaky mats in baths and stuff like that. But, yeah, and I do use a lot of Primula. It's a win for the Daxies. So, good.
Well,
but yes,
it's useful for the Daxies, isn't it? Because they're so close to the ground. It gives you an extra 4 inches.
Yep, I might be short, but they are very short. So, yeah, giving me that little arm extension definitely helps. But yeah, thank you very much. I will leave it there for the listeners. I will be back next week and I will see you all soon. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review and maybe share with a dog owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again. And we'll be back next week.